I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, who'd say them clear for the whole round world to hear.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you'd like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. You can also reach us via Facebook at www.facebook.com/Prison Voices Project. You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York, and this is the Prison Voices Project. I am your host this morning, Karanja K. Takaro, and today is Thursday, February 25th, 2016. This morning's show features an interview with Ronald Robertson, Executive Director of Brownsville Think Tank Matters, Incorporated. Mr. Robinson was formerly incarcerated for over 26 years at numerous correctional facilities throughout New York State, including Shawangunk Correctional and Greenhaven Correctional. My interview with Mr. Robinson focuses on the role of prison education from the perspective of those on the inside, along with prison education's impact on those who are returning citizens. Let us begin with a song by ALX entitled No Savior.
I'm no politician. I'm not even a student of politics. I'm not a Republican nor a Democrat and got sense enough to know
it. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Hey, so.
Yeah. ALX. Uh-huh. Yeah, your cats talking my chain. Yeah, y'all talking.
Barack Obama ain't no savior, neither was Jesse Jackson,
no,
neither was Malcolm or Martin,
no,
neither is Al Sharpton,
no, no, no.
David Dinkins wasn't no savior, neither was any mayor,
no,
if they was black, I don't even care. We gotta save ourselves,
real
we
right.
Gotta save ourselves.
Something like a Broadway play, the world is a stage, you got a part to play, play. You got something to say, say. All that talk about that savior is shit, savior. We gotta do what we gotta do. Nothing is impossible, not one man. It's gonna take a lot of you, a lot of us. Yeah, I'm talking about the whole populace. The day we come together, ain't no stopping us.
Respect you, Farrar and Garvey, Noble Drew Ali and all the fallen black leaders that spark me on for the cause. God, as long as my heart beats, my every thought deep, I'm plotting and planning until we all free. Teaching what was taught to me is each one teach one, cause that's the way it ought to be. The future's bright, that ain't hard to see. I'm about to make a t-shirt to say revolution starts with me. Enough respect.
Barack Obama ain't no savior, neither was Jesse Jackson,
no,
neither was Malcolm or Martin,
no,
neither is Al Sharpton,
no, no.
David Dinkins wasn't no savior, neither was any mayor,
no,
if
they was black, I don't even care. We gotta save ourselves, we gotta save ourselves.
I'm waiting for Jesus, I'm waiting for the black Messiah. They say a sucker's born any second, you know a pacifier. They want a pacifier, they want you waiting for salvation. Praying and hoping and wishing till your ass expire. In the casket lying on your back, your whole family crying. Keep with God now, say goodbye now. Meanwhile, the powers that be is having powwows about how to maintain their power while the planet dying.
Black and brown power, we got that back them down power. We can take this, we ain't gotta take this. Cause we the majority, officers, authorities put in place to protect the minorities from the bomb rush. It's us against a system that's unjust and lopsided. Every 5 minutes is cop sirens, but never the ambulance. Man, waiting for them, you don't stand a chance, fam. You better catch a cab, black.
Barack Obama ain't no savior. Neither was Jesse Jackson.
No.
Neither was Malcolm or Martin.
No.
Neither is Al Sharpton.
No. No.
David Dinkins wasn't no savior, neither was any mayor.
No,
if they was black, I don't even care.
Man, I don't even care, dog.
We gotta save ourselves, we gotta save ourselves.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about? Basically, all we saying is stop putting people on pedestals, man, regardless of who they are. Saying ain't no saviors out here, dog. Saying we all gotta put in work, we all gotta play our part. And as far as these politicians, we can't depend on these politicians. System ain't designed for us. It ain't designed for change. It's designed for the same thing over and over.
Sure.
If you don't understand that, man, I don't know what's going on.
No real.
Good morning. You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, and this is the Prison Voices Project. I began my interview with Mr. Ronald Robinson, director of the Brownsville think tank Matters, by asking some background information, starting with simply, who are you?
Well, today I'm powerful. I'm a proud human being. My given name is Ronald Robertson, and my chosen name is Powerful. And when I was younger, I was bullied, picked on, and, you know, I was like a child that would go into the house and not come outside because I was being bullied. But since then, I have gained my self-confidence, and I've gained knowledge of myself, awareness of who I am, and my history, and different aspects of my culture. And today, I'm an empowered human being, meaning that, you know, I took control of my life and my destiny, and I'm more empowered than I was as a young child. And that's where the name Powerful comes from, because today I stand before you and this audience as an empowered human being. At one time, I was just innocent and child, young child, I was bullied by other peers, I would say, in my community.
Where were you incarcerated?
I was incarcerated in various facilities throughout the state. I was incarcerated in Sing Sing, Fishkill, Greenhaven, Attica, Auburn, Clinton, Southport. Those are the main facilities I was incarcerated at throughout my incarceration.
And how long were you incarcerated?
Well, I spent 2 separate days in prison. The first prison stay was 10 years, from 78 to 88. And my last prison incarceration was from 1989 until 2014. 26 and a half years, my last prison stay.
All right. During your time on the inside, you know, today's show deals with prison education, so I'm curious to know what role did prison education play within your development and your growth on the inside, but also broadly, you know, on how it impacted your life in general.
Yeah. while he was dead, him and a number of other individuals had set up this program they referred to as the Black Think Tank. And out of the Black Think Tank, the program that came out was a Black History curriculum. And it was that curriculum that I enrolled in that gave me a sense of who I was as an individual. It gave me a lot of information about my history, my culture, and the values that we live by as a people. And I learned that from the coaching program. It had a great impact on my life. It helped me to look at who I was as an individual, my history, where I came from. It gave me a footing, you know, gave me a footing as to who I was and where I was going. There was other programs that came out of that. I guess we can explore that later, the Black Think Tank. But that was one of the first programs that impacted me. Later on in my incarceration, there's a program that Eddie Ellis, who's also one of the members of the Black Think Tank in New Haven, he created this program entitled the Resurrection Study Group. And it was a program to help people that was incarcerated to resurrect themselves, to pull themselves out of the muck and mire of the prison and the gangster culture and the hustling, et cetera, and to elevate ourselves back to our our greatness, really. The program helped us to evaluate where we're at, what led us to prison. You know, it showed us the impact of our criminal activity on our community, and then the access to really search deep down inside us what motivated us to engage in these criminal activities and what caused us to, you know, to basically destroy our communities. And once we sat down and evaluated that and assessed that and reflected on what we've done as individuals and what we've done to our community, it gave us a greater insight of the impact we have on our community. It gave us a start to thinking about what we were doing, why we were doing the things, and we started looking at it, how it was wrong and how we were just being an instrument and being involved in the destruction of our community. And just started thinking about that because we examined our rap sheet, all the career activity I got involved with, and we look at each one of those activities and how it impacted our community. And once we looked at that, we're like, yo, we didn't realize the impact that we was having on our community, how we was like instruments that also led to destruction of our community. And once we start seeing that, we start taking a different stance on the things we've done and, you know, start wanting to educate ourselves more about who we were and how we could help build our community instead of tear it down. And that was a great curriculum that was developed by Eddie Ellis.
So you mentioned the Black Think Tank and the Resurrection Study Group as two core prison education programs that were on the inside, created by folks on the inside, in order to transform the brothers who were active members within the class. Do I have that correct? All right. These were both at Green Haven?
Yes, both of those were at Green Haven. They originated from, as I said earlier, the Black Think Tank. And not just that program, but from the Black Think Tank, most of all of the programs that we currently see in the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision came up out of the Black Think Tank. The Black Think Tank, after the Attica riot, a lot of the members that were everybody members, but a lot of the people that were incarcerated during the Attica riot was transferred out of Attica into different facilities. They went from Attica to Auburn to Eastern Correctional Facility to Greenhaven and to Comstock. A large percentage of them went to Greenhaven, and the men that was transferred from Attica to Greenhaven, they set up the Black Think Tank, and they thought about their conditions, they thought about their incarceration and the impact it had on them and their community. And from that, they began to generate these different program activities from the Black History Coaching Program, which is Malcolm X Black History Program, to the Resurrection Study Group by Eddie Ellis. Another member of the Black Think Tank was Luke Maughan. His name was Larry White. He developed another program I took in, while I was incarcerated, called the Liberation Study Group. And the Liberation Study Group is more oriented towards politics and communities and the impact that politics had on our community and, you know, the prison system. We start looking at at one time. It was trailer that was located on a facility ground where you and your family members could come to your wife or your mother, your children, your siblings, etc., could spend 2 days inside these trailer houses that was located on a facility. And you can see it was 2 days. That was an idea that came out of the Black Think Tank. The pre-release center came out of the Black Think Tank. The pre-release center was a program in which when you were like a year or 2 years close to being released from prison, you would go there and acquire some insight and some training, some preparation to help you transition back into the community. That came out of the Black Think Tank. The college program, the request to have college come into the prison system came out of the Black Think Tank. A lot of the programs that we see in the prison came out of the Black Think Tank and was ultimately usurped or adopted by corrections. And they too did add their own little spin on it, but a lot of the programs we see in the system came out of Black Think Tank, and that was a program to help a lot of incarcerated people to transform their criminal mindset and adopt a more conscious perspective on life.
I then followed up asking what programs Mr. Robinson was involved in helping to create on the inside.
The first program I got involved with, as far as actually being involved in developing a set of curriculum, that was in Green Haven, and the program was Rehabilitation Through the Arts. And this is a program we see now that exists in Sing Sing, and that was co-opted by the woman that runs the program today. But in Green Haven, there was a number of men that came together, and, you know, a lot of people were interested in music, singing, drawing, painting, etc. And the NAACP that was set up in Green Haven by a lot of members of the Black Think Tank had came up with a different idea of how people could spend their time into transition or transform themselves with this criminal mentality. They thought that by using the arts, was a good idea, and I was a part of that committee that created that program, Rehabilitation to the Arts, to help people rehabilitate themselves to writing, to drawing, etc. That was the first program I was involved with in development, and we developed that program in Green Haven back in 1982. Later on, as I got involved with the NAACP, I also helped create a program there in the NAACP, and even a program like physical education program, etc. But as I went on, I've also created a number of other programs in prison to help with the transformation of other incarcerated people. One of the programs is called A Challenge to Change, and we refer to that C2C, and it helped people to purge themselves with a criminal mentality and adopting some life-affirming guiding principles, you know, that was consistent with who we are as a people. And some of the principles that we adopted were the seven principles of Kwanzaa that we had adopted into the program and showed the individual how it was a body system by which we should live by, that we should adopt and help guide us along the right paths. And because a lot of the codes that we adopted and we live by, these street codes and these prison codes, are going to help us survive in the street as we're out there hustling, selling drugs, you know, involved in gang culture. And the values that we adopted in prison and the codes help us to survive in prison. But once we return to our community, those same codes and principles that we adopted in the street and prison was antagonistic to who we were in our community and the things that we needed to do as members of the community. Because a lot of the codes that we adopted, for instance, one of the things, we don't want to answer nobody, we consider ourselves our own boss. We don't want to be a part of any group or somebody would dictate to us what we had to do or what we should do. We want to come out and do our own. We don't want to listen to anybody. That was one of the prison codes. We have to be independent. And today, even when we left prison back then, it was like something that put us at odds against our community and didn't allow us to work or look at getting jobs or taking jobs as something that was beneficial, because then we had to answer to somebody. But one of the codes that we adopted in the street and we lived by in prison was that don't answer nobody, be your own boss. And it caused a problem in like integrating into the workspace. You know, so that was one of the programs we created, the Challenge to Change, that helped a lot of people with the program that I created to help myself. I created a coaching program, the same coaching class,
I was also interested in knowing who were the people that Mr. Robinson interacted with that contributed to his respect for education, especially through programs that were being created on the inside.
And that's what really began that, because prior to being transferred to Green Angel from Elmira Correctional Facility, I was running rapid, crazy, you know, my old name was Cowboy, and I was acting like I wanted to be a cowboy, always fighting, always in some kind of brawl, had this chip on my shoulder, you know, being picked on when I was young. And so when I was transferred into Green Angel back in early 1982, they had the Black Study Program, and everybody had thought they were somebody, whether it was a gangster or a hustler or somebody that was involved in the culture, was enrolled in the Green Haven Black Studies Program, the Malcolm X Black Studies Program that was developed by Cardell Shears, Blood, and his right-hand man, what do we call him again, Butch Harvey. And Blood had taught general history, Black history in the class, and Butch Harvey had taught a lot of cosmetic science, ancient Egyptian history. And so when I enrolled in the program, I noticed that anybody in that jail that considered themselves somebody was in that program. And I said, yo, everybody in there, all the so-called gangsters, hustlers, historians, etc. was in the program. So when I was in the program, I met Herman Bell, one of the members of the Black Panther Party, who was still incarcerated and been incarcerated for about 30 years. I met the Rupert Benoit. He was in the program. I met Larry White, who they referred to as Wigmar, through that program. I met a lot of the so-called, even Eddie Ellis, a lot of the so-called mentors, not so-called, a lot of the mentors that I met in the Black Studies program. And we got a lot of members in the Black Studies program thought it was necessary to set up the NAACP. And they set up a chapter of NAACP in Green Haven, and they used that as the political arm of the Black Studies program. And I became a clerk in the Black Studies program and in the NAACP. And I used to type up a lot of the proposals that these guys would create. And I would read the proposals and look at the structure. They helped really develop my insight and create proposals and programs myself. But among them, as I said, was Eddie Ellis, Larry White, Cardell Sears, Herman Bell, DeRuba Dinbar, Lonnie McLeod, all a lot of so-called prison legends that they I met at Green Haven and the Black Studies program. And what would happen would be I would say certain things in class, and any others would say something like, nah, that's not correct. That mindset is destructive to our community. Or they would say something in the class, and all the elders in the class, if they heard one of the young people in the class say something that was inconsistent was, counterintuitive or counterproductive to our community, they would check it, they would correct us. And that would be only corrected. They would correct it by chastisement. They would give us some type of historical perspective. Mm-hmm. They would talk about some things that I learned in there from what they created, another project later on, the non-judicial approach. But it would tell us about this criminal mindset and the socioeconomic conditions in our community, how that these crime generative factors that refer to them as, and that would lead to crime generative behavior. And we talked about the law employment and the crime in our community, how it impacted our community, the value of our community, and how it impacted our school system and the money that was directed toward our school system, how that impacted our education, and how we got an inferior education as a result, and how it led a lot of us to prison. And when they start putting that in some type of historical perspective, a lot of us in that program, the program, I never looked at it like that. I remember one key example is a guy that I knew that was so-called hustling, used to sell drugs. And he said he sold drugs because he couldn't get a job. But he was key on education. We need education, we need superior education, we need this, we need that. And when we was in the class one time, we lot of people in class, and we started seeing that, we started making connections to other things that we were doing. And the elders in the class helped us to see that.
You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, and this is the Prison Voices Project. I'm your host this morning, Karanja Keita Carroll, and you are listening to an interview with Ronald Robertson, Executive Director of Brownsville Think Tank Matters. We'll have a little musical interlude with a song from Gary Clark Jr. entitled Travis County. WGXC 90.7 FM. This is the Prison Voices Project, and you just listened to Gary Clark Jr., Travis County. And in continuing my interview with Mr. Ronald Robertson, Executive Director of Brownsville Think Tank Matters, I asked Mr. Robinson what was the significance of prison education programs that were created by those on the inside.
Creation of these programs was really important, specifically ones that were created by incarcerated people. A lot of people that were in prison didn't have any choice in the prison system. We didn't think that they valued what they were, and a lot of the programs they created was more toward punishment. with education, etc., and that they were drafted in these different facilities and decided to come up with these black think tanks in the different facilities and create these programs. They thought that it was consistent with what they were and it addressed the need that they had, that they needed, and they created this program. So, for instance, we created a kid literacy program in Greenhaven. And the program was created by incarcerated people for incarcerated people, and it comprised of several incarcerated people, because a lot of us in prison didn't have, like I said, any real trust in the prison system. We thought that a lot of the program didn't address a lot of the needs that we had, that the needs that our community had, demanded of us, because a lot of us in prison, like I said, was hustlers, et cetera. A lot of the prison programs didn't address that. If we wanted to address that, we wanted just education that ensure that the members of these programs, when they return to their community, return to their communities as assets instead of liabilities, and we wanted them to return to the community as contributing members of the communities and law abiding, all the things that went with that. But let me get back to that. The programming is important because, as I said earlier, a lot of people incarcerated didn't trust the prison staff, and a lot of programs didn't address our specific needs. So in the prison, members like Eddie Ellen, Herman Bell, et cetera, thought that they needed to come up with our own programs to address the specific needs of our community. And when they adjusted the program, their program was created by people just like us, people that we looked up to, people that we valued, people that we trusted. And when they made connections to the program they created in our community, how the program impacted us, how it impacted our community, we were able to see the connection with the prison program that was created by the administrative staff. We were seeing the connection. We just saw programs that was based on punishment, programs that just had us just spend time and basically doing nothing, that never addressed any of our concerns, our community concerns, our educational needs. They were putting this putting in there to, just waste time, basically. But the other individuals that came later on, these mentors, these elders, we thought that we needed a program that addressed our specific needs, and that people were constantly, we trusted those who were incarcerated like us because they came from the same place we came from. They experienced some of the same things that we experienced, and we took that out of better insight. And when they created these programs spoke directly to us with our needs for us, and we were able to respect those people who joined the program because they were people that we looked up to as mentors and people to admire, former gangsters, present Black Panthers, and hustlers who transformed themselves, that we saw with them, that we saw their transformation, and we thought that, they made the transformation, it was okay for us to make that same transformation, that we didn't have to look at ourselves as being weak, or, put down because we had made that transformation, but we made it because they made it. But the education was very important, because the show that we were self-sufficient, and that we could create a program that addressed our specific needs, and that we could do it ourselves, and we didn't need to support anyone outside. And we've done that. And all of the programs, as I said earlier, that basically that DOCS co-opted and adopted were programs were created by us. And once we saw that we could create those programs, we thought it was really important that we create our own programs. And we did that from the historical program to the computer technology program to the coaching program, on and on and on. We were able to do that. But it was important to see us creating our programs and getting those specific roles as educators and leaders, et cetera. That was really inspiring to the prison population.
I concluded my interview with Mr. Robertson by asking how prison education contributes to the work that he is doing today.
Okay, I had a transformative experience on the inside, what a lot would call an aha moment, an awakening, when I was incarcerated. And one of the programs I talked about was a challenge to change how we adjust our criminal mindsets while I was in prison and to transform that mindset. While I was in a group discussion in prison in one of the classes, particularly the challenge to change class, we had an argument, a discussion, mind you, on violence, when violence was appropriate. And we mainly talked about our community because that's what we came from, that's what we determined to. hurt my family and I impact my community, I start to see it more and more and more. And later on, as we return to the class and continue the discussion, I showed I was on the wrong side of the argument. And then my mother's voice was reverberating in my head. She would say something like, "Brother, you know better, you do better." And at that time, I said, "Yo, I got to stop this nonsense. I got to stop all this fighting and this lobbying, you know, this self destruction, and start doing something more positive." So I started getting more involved in the positive programs. And at that time, I said that I'm no longer going to be involved in this negativity and destruction of our community. I'm going to be involved in the building of our community. And a lot of this sort of input and the insight I gained from a lot of the elders that were involved in the program, they helped me to see the impact that it caused. So I took that no longer was going to lead or mislead individuals that was following me because I fought a lot and I had gained a reputation in the prison system and on the street as cowboy. People like clung to me and I fought and protected a lot of people and it was looked up to me. And I saw that I was misleading up on the wrong path and I was misleading them right to prison as the elders showed me how it led to crime or genetic behavior and attitude and led me right to prison. And once I saw that, I said, I got to stop that. Now I got to give back. And I decided at that point, I'm going to make it my sacred obligation instead of misleading the individual and leading the prison to lead them into the business center, into the culture, institutional community, into empower them to be better individuals and to empower the community, be a large part of the community. And I remember that transition in prison, so I got more involved in different programs that were created by incarcerated people, that was programs that would add value to who we were. And I got involved in those programs, and I got more involved in the African Culture Awareness Organization, a lot of coaching, doing some activities to make connections, to network with different people that can help me once I transition back into the community. And so in October 14, 2014, I was released from prison after doing 26 and a half years in prison. When I left prison with a whole different mentality. My first incarceration, I left prison with the same criminal mentality, going home, getting involved in the drug field, selling drugs. The first thing I wanted when I came home was a gun. I thought I needed a gun to protect myself from the enemies I created, enemies from fighting, from robbing, etc. This time when I came home with a whole different mindset. I didn't come home with the criminal mentality. I came home as an empowered human being, as I said earlier, empowered by history, culture, and values. And I saw the connections and the impact. So I'm no longer going to be involved in that. So when I came home, I'm going to get involved in some positive activity that will help me to empower and uplift my community. And one of the things I helped develop and plan just before I came home was an organization. It's an organization I talked to my family members, my cousin in particular, and other people I knew in the community, and a couple of professors that I knew that I met while I was incarcerated. And one of the things I wanted to do was set up an organization that would help me to give back to my community, to fulfill my civil obligations to give back, and to empower those that follow me and take them off that crooked path that I put them on, and take them on the straight path, you know, to give back to their community and to also help other members of their community. And this organization that I talked to individuals to my cosplay to create was defined as or named as the Brownsville Think Tank Matters. It was an organization we wanted to set up in Brownsville because I'm originally from Oceanville, Brownsville, a person of the Brownsville community, and this is where I grew up at, this is where I did a lot of my wrong. So we wanted to create a program in our community that was community based at the epicenter of a lot of the violence. And Brownsville Think Tank Matters, it is a think tank basically based on the black think tank that I was a part of, or not even a part of, that the members who created it that helped influence me and give me special education. We want to create it now, a community-based think tank. It was like it's Brownsville Think Tank, and we want to address matters that pertain to our community. And so we named the Brownsville Think Tank Matters, a think tank based in Brownsville that will consider and address a lot of the matters that that pertain to our community. And one of the matters that we wanted to confront was the gang violence that was going on in our community and the destruction of our community by quote unquote gangs, etc. And the lack of history, culture, values, the lack of networking resources that exist in our community and services. So we put together the Brownsville Think Tank Matters. Now, I was involved in the creation of the establishment in prison, and my cousin helped police brutality, of stop and frisk, depression among teens, poverty, depression, a plethora of issues in young people. And so we began to do this program, set up our program in local community centers. And the first place we established our program in Tubby, built our space, was Brownsville Recreation Center, based in the heart of Brownsville. And the director allowed us to use that space because he liked what we were doing, and we wanted to keep this office and the great issues in our community. So he allowed us to use that space until we got our space set up. So we ultimately got our space set up to open in early 2015, around April 2015, was able to open up the space. And now, since we opened up the space, we secured like a number of contracts, like four contracts with this big organization, a good separate services organization, to teach life skills, conflict resolution, job readiness, and what else? Conflict resolution, life skills, and leadership and government skills. That's all the skill that we teach. And also now, I'm a mentor with the Good Shepherd Services Organization, where I facilitate a workshop around those same principles, life skill, conflict resolution, leadership development, on Tuesdays and Thursdays in the Brownsville community for housing projects, the Bad Bank housing projects. And also, I was able to acquire a job working with Life Care Inc., an organization that's based in Queens. And I do the same thing, as I said, you know, my simple obligation with empowering young people. I work with Erica Ford, who's the executive director, and we are what they refer to as a cure down site. In which we approach crime in our community from a public health perspective, not from a criminal justice perspective. And what we do, we go out and patrol our streets, and we patrol our own community. Some of our community policing, there's a model that came out of Chicago, a ceasefire model, that we refer to in New York as cure violence. And we look at crime from a disease perspective. We look at violence as a disease. And just like doctors, doctors without borders will go on to a, like say, a nation, and they'll identify a particular disease and try to isolate it, address it, and provide services for the people in those nations. We do the same thing with the cure violence model. What we do, we send them what we refer to as violence interrupters, to that was once in gangs, that was once in drugs, the dominant drug culture, that once in violence and then prison stints, and came home and wanted to get back to their community, but that's still connected in some sense, like a former gang member, they're doing gangs in their community. So if we do that, we hire them as what we call violence interrupters. They're almost like a doctor. We'll go ahead and identify the disease, then we go on to the community and identify where violence is occurring, who's involved in violence situations like gangs, etc. We will collect intel, and we'll come back to our office, we'll discuss it, and we'll put down strategies to help reduce the violence, to help resolve a lot of conflicts. And once we resolve the conflict now, we'll send what we call outreach workers. And these outreach workers, so like doctors and provide services like the ones that can make sure that we help. They go into the community now, they identify these gang members that are fighting for these drug sellers. They ask them, what do you need? Do you need a job? Do you need some type of legal services? Do you need financial assistance? Do you need housing assistance? Do you have two parents in your household? Do you get a hot meal every day? And once we identify their needs, we adopt young people in our community now inconsistent with our community. And this is something that helped me to create the child agenda program that prevents individuals from discriminating child. And also the reverend program like the Veterans Study Group that NUS created, the Liberation Study Group that Larry had created. Because one thing served us to create students, served us how values and principles and ideologies that came from one region of the land, which he referred to as the Northern Cradle, and the values that came from another section of the world, we referred to as the Southern Cradle, and the Southern Cradle was the Africa, like this epicenter of the Southern Cradle, how certain values and principles and codes and ideologies evolved out that's more consistent with our work as a person and helped us as a people to move forward. And some of these same values are still consistent today, and even values that got us out of slavery held us together as a people, helped us to build and to create for ourselves. And when we saw that how the other values that came out of the Northern Cradle, like capitalism and individualism, were inconsistent with the other people, when we started seeing the connection, we saw how it was important for us to build organizations that brought our people together. And one of the principles we adopted at Brown's Distinct Matter is a homonymy. And this is sorry, any term that you know is a let's put together. And we use all these concepts and principles to put ourselves together as a people and to counter and contribute to innovation and resources and more important support system our people needed in order to transform themselves from these liabilities into assets. And all of this stuff for me came from my prison education, from me meeting these elders, as I mentioned last night, Luke Mom, Tyler Bass, Shears, Hannah Bell, the Winston Wall, Lonnie McCloud, and the list goes on and on, and did a Barclays program that was very transformative in my life, and it helped me to get to the place I am today. And the wonderful for these individuals and these programs, I would be where I am today, able to now acquire a work that will allow me to purchase a car, you know, pay rent, you know, take my wife out and live a life without fear, when I have to worry about being out here hustling, selling drugs, destroying my community, wondering where I'm, when will I be going to jail, when will somebody shoot me and kill me. You know, now I can just live, man, my life without worry. You know, and I'm in a much better place, and my transition last time as compared to now is nothing. And as I tell a lot of people, my worst day in the street is better than my best day in prison. Because today, you know,
and this concludes my interview with Mr. Ronald Robinson, Executive Director of Brownsville Think Tank Matters. If you would like to get in contact with Mr. Robinson and find out more about the work that he's doing, he can be reached at 718-484-2485. The mailing address for Brownsville Think Tank Matters Incorporated is 48 New Lots Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11212. You can also reach Brownsville Think Tank Matters by sending them an email, and their email address is brownsvillethinktankmatters@gmail.com. You can also find them online at www.brownsvillethinktankmatters.org. You are listening to the Prison Voices Project here on WGXC 90.7 FM, and I'm your host, Karanja Kate Zaccaro. Our interview this morning with Ronald Robinson concentrated most broadly on the significance of education, and more specifically on the significance of prison education programs that have been created by those on the inside, and the transformative nature in which these programs help to create human beings that are committed to changing themselves, changing the people around them, and once they are returning citizens, are committed to changing their environments. And I believe that the interview with Mr. Robinson is reflective of this process. You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of the people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM.
If you're listening to the program and you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Please remember that we can also be found on Facebook at www.facebook.com/prisonvoicesproject.
To be me, then you'd see.